Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, how did your eyes feel after staring at that eclipse last week? Did you wonder if those $2 glasses that you used were, you know, the real thing? We speak with Park City resident and Dr. Barbara Worosko, an ophthalmologist, who will talk about that and also the company that she founded that has since been acquired and become EyeGate Pharmaceuticals, a company on the cutting edge of science and eye health.
And then we're going to talk about earthquakes. We have nothing to worry about here in Park City or in Utah. Well, wait a minute. Think again. We always thought that San Francisco was the town that needed to worry about it. But as it turns out, there are fault lines everywhere in this area, and they're big ones, too. So we're going to be speaking with award-winning science journalist Catherine Miles about her new book, Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake.
This is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Hi, Dan Dearden here, owner of Just Right Air and new sponsor of KPCW Programming. Just Right Air has been advising Park City area homeowners to repair, replace, and maintain their heating and air conditioning since 2004. Details at justrightair.com.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design. Love your home.
Hi, this is Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. This summer, Park City Mountain offers a variety of events for the whole family, including the annual July 4th celebration and fireworks, summer concert series, and weekly Wednesday Farmers Market. The full calendar of Park City Mountain events is available at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Well, the eclipse may seem distant, even though we experienced that natural wonder just last week. Well, how did you feel after the eclipse, after staring at the sun through those cheap glasses that we all used? Joining us in the studio is our local eye expert, ophthalmologist Dr. Barbara Worosko. She was the co-founder of Jade Therapeutics, which has now been acquired and has become EyeGate Pharmaceuticals. She joins us to talk eclipse viewing and about the advances her company is making in developing the proprietary science that allows better eye health. Okay, it's called, and it's a mouthful, and I'm going to try it. It utilizes transscleral iontophoresis to deliver optimal therapeutic levels of drug directly into the targeted ocular tissue. Well, if that doesn't make sense to you, Dr. Worosko joins us to explain. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Lynn, and thank you so much. And thank you, John, too. It's always such a pleasure to be here.
We like that we have a resident ophthalmologist who can explain these things. And it is funny, we were saying we should have had you on before the eclipse to talk about that, but I didn't really think about it because there was all this hype about the safe glasses and you could look directly at the eclipse and I felt great about it. I stayed here in Park City. But then immediately after, I felt really funny and my eyes hurt. I almost, you know, went home from work. I had a headache. And I thought, well, if I'm feeling this, a lot of other people are as well. And so, of course, Dr. Barbara Worosko popped into my head. So, well, I mean, first of all, those glasses were cheap. I mean, what was in them to protect us? And were they really protecting us?
So they're basically blackout glasses. And when it said ISO, it's really the standardization. I think the big concern that we had, you know, amongst the industry and the ophthalmologists and the university is suddenly we had glasses that we weren't sure were actually ISO or ISO verified, meaning ISO is a standardization, sort of like the FDA. So you get the stamp of approval, and we couldn't confirm. We have not, though, had any cases or heard thus far of anybody that's actually had eye damage from glasses that were insufficient to protect them. So I think overall, even though there was a concern that some of the glasses were too cheap and perhaps weren't adequately verified, they probably did okay. And I was surprised. I asked my resident actually on Monday, because he was the one that was on call that day of the eclipse. And he said, no, there really weren't any phone calls coming in, which was really good news. So yeah. We were worried.
Yeah, that's surprising to me, judging on how I felt. And I think that it came into people's field of sort of realization that, in fact, we never look at the sun. And I didn't realize it till that morning when I thought, okay, I'm just going to find where the sun is and look at it really quickly. I don't know.
What's interesting is actually you can damage your retina. So that's where the whole concern comes from. So what happens is the ultraviolet light, the longer rays, which are generally UVA and even infrared, invisible light, enter into the eye and go to the photoreceptors and the retinal pigment epithelium, which is the back lining of the retina, and that's where the damage occurs. So you've got this impulse of light. The cells then convert that to basically an electrical signal, and it's oxidative damage. Sort of very similar to a sunburn, you know, on your skin when you think about it. It's those rays. But what's interesting is even looking at the sun for less than a minute could give you that type of solar retinopathy. But that's pretty intense, you know, if you're looking at the sun that long. But it can be very quick, and it can happen even just, like you said, just sun gazing.
Yeah.
Well, of course, my eyes did not hurt until I talked to Lynn, and then my eyes started hurting. No. My eyes always hurt, but the solar eclipse was tremendous, and a lot of people enjoyed it. It sort of screwed up our pledge drive there for that first day, but we caught up. Everybody was so focused on it. But let's talk a moment about living at altitude and how that is different. I was born and raised on at sea level, and now I live about 7,200 feet where my house is, and of course I'm hiking throughout all of these mountains here. It could 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 feet, 11,000 feet. What are the sorts of effects that are different between sea level and where we are here?
So oxygenation, you know, basically that for sure. We see different types of levels of oxygen here. You know, you're more likely to have lower oxygen. That's why your red blood cells actually increase. People train at higher altitudes to make more red blood cells to carry the thinner oxygen, so to speak, and that can affect your eyes. Probably one of the biggest things that we worry about is sun damage overall. You know, skin-wise, we're always telling people to use sun, you know, sun protection, clothing, hats. But even with your eyes, we don't put suntan lotion on our eyelids. And your eyelids are probably one of the most likely places to get skin cancer. And we don't think about that. We think about melanomas, basal cells, squamous cells on other parts of our body. But you can also get it on your eye as well. So ultraviolet light can damage the surface of your eye, the globe. It can damage the cornea, and it can also increase your risk of cataracts. And what we're learning also is, like anything, it's sun exposure as you're young. You know, the three of us, you know, you look at your skin, you go, God, I wish I didn't lay out and put baby oil, you know, years ago when I was a teenager. Who would have thought? But really, I think we're becoming wiser. I think our kids are going to be better off down the road because they're being more knowledgeable about sun damage. And you can absolutely damage almost every layer of your eye with extended sun exposure.
Do sunglasses provide any SPF at all to the eyelids?
Yes, they do. And there's a range. So there's, we always hear UVA and UVB, but there's also UVC, which are the shorter wavelengths.
Right.
And in fact, they all damage. And some of them enter. So what's interesting, too, is the cornea will absorb some of the shorter UVC and UVB. And then the lens will get the UVB and the UVA and absorb that. So that will give you a cataract. And then, as I mentioned, the longer rays then get into the retina. So your eye's trying to protect itself. You know, it's trying to do a really good job to absorb that UV light, because ultimately, if you damage the retina, that's more of a, it could be more of a permanent damage.
Mm-hmm. Well, we get a lot of bluebird days here where, you know, it's not a cloud in the sky. It's absolutely beautiful. And if we're outdoors for long periods of time, it can really push on you. And a friend of mine who I was playing golf with said he was told by his doctor, his ophthalmologist, that if you wear sunglasses, you will decrease the chance of cataracts. So he's learned how to play golf with sunglasses. Not an easy thing to do if you've never played golf with sunglasses, but is that something we should consider doing?
Yes, absolutely, because that's the lens that's absorbing that ultraviolet light. So if you think of the eye as sort of a camera, you've got the front, the cornea, the clear part, and then your pupil, your iris, then your lens, which basically moves like a lens in a camera. That's how you focus. And we read it near when the lens changes shape. And then the retina is the film, so to speak. And the cataract does absorb, the lens does absorb a lot of that UV light. And too much UV light can then increase the incidence or the progression of cataracts. So maybe you'll get cataracts a little bit sooner or earlier on in your life than, say, if you had UV protection all the time. Although those studies have not been done because, again, it's really starting sunglasses earlier, you know, as youngsters.
Right.
Teenagers.
Right. I didn't know this was a thing. I'm not a golfer. Do most golfers go without glasses because there's something difficult about the when you swing or something, your glasses go flying out?
I'm just speaking for me personally is that I mean, it just seems very awkward. It doesn't seem right. And so I should probably force myself to wear sunglasses. But a lot of people do wear sunglasses. I've just, every time I've tried to do it when I'm playing golf, it just doesn't seem to work for me.
I think the biggest thing, too, to consider is even on overcast days, just like you can get a sunburn, you should still be wearing sunglasses. And sometimes we don't think of that.
Yes, yes. Well, you're not the only famous doctor in town. We have this other famous doctor who I think is a colleague of yours, Dr. Jeff Tabin, and we've heard a lot about his the cataract clinics that he started in the Himalayas. And there, as we know, because they are probably, well, they live at a much higher elevation than we do here, so more harmful, they're exposed to more harmful UV rays and probably aren't wearing sunglasses a lot of the time. And I think you can probably give me the data or the statistics, but there's an alarming number of people who have gone blind because of cataracts, but they're fairly easy to remove.
Yes, so cataracts actually are one of the leading causes of blindness. Depending upon where you look in the world, it's either cataracts, macular degeneration, or glaucoma. And a lot of it determines, a lot of, you know, the statistics are determined by the access. So if it's, you know, in a country like ours where cataracts can be taken out, it's not going to be a leading cause of blindness. But elsewhere in the world where you don't have the advances in the technology and these villages are very remote, yes, it is it's a risk of blindness. And it's younger patients too. You're absolutely right. And these cataracts become so white that these patients, you know, count fingers, hand motion, they really can't see. And once you take the cataract out, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And yes, Jeff and his wife are both good friends of mine, and the work that he's done throughout the world is really incredible.
Yes, yes. Okay, a little silly question perhaps, but I have a 13-year-old dog. And as we know, our dogs, as they get older, they start to get this sort of white look across their eyes. Are those cataracts?
It depends. It could be the cornea if it's in front of the pupil or the colored, but if it's in the pupil, so if you look through their iris and through their pupil and it's no longer looking black, it's looking white, yes, that's a cataract.
Oh, goodness. Is this something that Park City folks do? Give their dogs cataract surgery?
You can.
I have no idea.
You can, yeah. There's veterinarian ophthalmologists throughout the world, especially for guide dogs or for military dogs. You know, these dogs, German Shepherds, you put a lot of time and money into training them, the police dogs, and yes, you can do cataract surgery, even on fish.
Okay, wait. Why does a fish need to see? A guide fish? Is that what you're talking about?
An expensive, rare fish.
Well, this is Park City. We're going to get our fish fixed, that's for sure. what else can you tell us about eye health at altitude?
Dryness. So, you know, one thing you said about your eyes hurting, and almost everybody I see, you know, as a practitioner, all my patients complain of dry eye. And again, it's very, very common around the world, but it's really common here because we have very low humidity. And right now, I think everybody's feeling it. It is just so dry out there. Mm-hmm. You go for a hike and you're just dying. It's, yeah, there's no moisture in the air. So again, our eyes suffer. And we don't get older, but as our eyes get older, they produce less tears. So hormones change. The tear film changes, the amount of oils decrease, and that also just aggravates dryness. And on top of that, very little moisture in the air, and now you've got a setup, especially if you're out golfing and playing tennis. You know, you're exposed, your eyes open, or if you're staring, you know, for several minutes and not blinking, your eye's going to dry out, and it's going to be painful. It's going to be irritated.
It's those blinking contests.
Oh, right.
So we're all challenged because of the dryness in the area, but I have a couple of friends whose eye ducts, tear ducts, do not produce tears anymore. Is there anything coming in the science and technology area that will help to alleviate that?
So you guys maybe have seen some of the recent ads. So Restasis has been around for a while. It's an anti-inflammatory. And Shire just came out with a new medication that's a topical anti-inflammatory, very similar to Restasis, works a little bit differently, and they're both anti-inflammatories. Not steroids, but they work differently, and it's called Xiidra. And that also actually has been a great addition sort of to our potpourri of things that we can offer patients. And there's, oh, you guys are going to laugh at this one. There's another one, another device that just was approved. And it's actually a nasal stimulator. So what you do is you stick something in your nose, and it basically kind
of... Not your finger.
It makes it irritated, so then it then triggers your eyes to tear. Because, right, if you think about it, if you start to sneeze, your eyes can water. If you're irritated, your eyes water. So it's that philosophy.
That doesn't sound very comfortable.
I know. We'll see how... you know, what the uptake is, the use of that one is. But it's interesting concept.
For our listeners who would like to learn more about Shire, could you spell that for them?
S-H-I-R-E. And the medication is Xiidra. Mm. X-I-I-D-R-A, Xiidra, yeah.
Yeah. Take us back through the co-founding of Jade Therapeutics, which was acquired and now is iGate Pharmaceuticals, and the connection it has to both the University of Utah and the Moran Eye Center.
Yes. So Jade was originally started 7 years ago. So my co-founder and I took a invention that actually came out of the University of Utah. So it was developed at the University of Utah. We took that invention and then we basically developed a company around it. And what the University of Utah does, which actually also MIT does, and other universities, Stanford, some of the larger, more innovative universities, is they enable researchers and scientists to take ideas and basically start companies, and they really support that. They give you resources. You can also get some grant funding depending upon it, how your relationship is. And for us, we stayed on the campus of the University of Utah and developed this compound into a topical eye drop that actually helps dry eye and helps repair the cornea. We started working with the military, with the Department of Defense. We got some funding from the National Science Foundation, and we got it to a point that it then became attractive to a larger public company, and that company happened to be iGate. So we could only bring it so far. We brought it through preclinical testing, but then when you get to the point where you need to put a lot of money behind it, millions of dollars, a public company is actually ideal because you can then partner with them. In this case, they acquired us.
Okay.
And then they gave us now the funding, or they are giving up me. We have the funding now to move it forward into the clinic.
Right. So this is just fascinating to me, the University of Utah as an academic and research institution encourages this kind of entrepreneurship. And it just seems to make so much sense. We're speaking off air about how, you know, some university settings may feel like it is giving away their power or their control to allow a business to develop on their very footprint. But this is a great thing about the University of Utah. It keeps people innovating and it keeps them from stagnating in their research. And I mean, are there any, what are the downsides, if any?
So to work through. So the one thing that the U has as well, and I know other universities, University of Washington, again, MIT, Stanford, they have tech transfer offices. So their offices, there are offices on campus that actually focus on writing up these agreements and these contracts to try to move the ideas out of the university. Because you're right. I mean, if an inventor has a great idea and comes up and patents this new great, you know, next best molecule to treat glaucoma, for instance, if they don't help that person move it forward and or get other people interested in it, it's never going to develop. It's going to die on the bench. So it's really a very, very collaborative effort from, you know, lawyers, researchers, finance. Park City Angels, you know, has been involved in a lot of that. But it's a lot of effort. It's a lot of time and effort. And you need to think outside the box. The university really needs to see ultimately the bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. MIT does a great job with taking their innovators and helping them with the labs that they have on campus in Cambridge and allowing them to bring their ideas from one stage to another. And yeah, they help them with venture capitalists and with introductions to lawyers and maybe some mentors and those sorts of things. But MIT does a pretty good job. And University of Utah is a very good environment for people to bring ideas forward.
Yep. In fact, the University of Utah now is ranked second with MIT first in the number of innovations and startup companies that come out of their doors, so to speak.
Wow. Impressive.
Yeah, it's very impressive.
So you've talked about macular degeneration, glaucoma, and cataracts as the three leading causes of blindness, I think, or issues that appear with your eyes. And so the product that you've developed through Jade Therapeutics and now iGate Pharmaceuticals can help glaucoma. I know that. What about macular degeneration?
No, so we don't focus on that. We actually focus on corneal healing.
Okay.
So the polymer actually helps with healing the cornea.
Yeah, and so essentially this is a polymer that has the medication in a time-release fashion. So you put it in the eye, and is it like a contact lens sort of thing?
So one of the things we're developing is a contact lens-like film that would deliver medications primarily in military-type situations, battlefield. And then we've also been developing this polymer just as an eye drop, as a standalone. So there's so much animal work. This polymer actually has been around now for about 5 years in the veterinarian space, again, being used to heal corneal abrasions, scratches, dry eye, ulcers or irritations that don't heal. So it's hyaluronic acid, which is part of our body.
Oh, right. Hyaluronic acid. That is used in dermatological things recently. So
yes.
Again, I suppose it's all about moisture, right?
Yes, moisture, lubrication. And it's interesting. So we lose hyaluronic acid in our skin as we get older.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see babies, you know, their skin just heals so beautifully and there's no scarring and it's smooth. And it's because of all that excess, not even excess, but they just have so much hyaluronic acid in their skin. We have it throughout our whole body, skin, knees, lubrication, and cushioning. You know, it's in our knee, it's in our synovial fluid, and it's also the main substance in the back of the eye, in the vitreous.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were asking me about the floaters before, the little squiggly things, so your vitreous, your jelly inside your eye is predominantly hyaluronic acid with some collagen and elastin and cells.
Ah, so this is a product that those of us who just have dry eyes, those of us who don't have necessarily some of these more grave issues with our eyes can use. Is it on the market?
Not on the market yet, but hopefully with the clinical studies, we should actually have it being launched in about a year, year and a half.
Finally, can people find you at the Moran Eye Center here? Oh, so you're
yes.
Not just in Salt Lake, you're here.
Nope, I'm here. I'm here on Wednesdays, and then I'm also down at the VA with the residents for glaucoma clinic, and then down in my lab during
Excellent.
The week, but here on Wednesdays.
Okay. Dr. Barbara Worosko, she is the co-founder of what was Jade Therapeutics. It's now iGate Pharmaceuticals. She's with the Moran Eye Center, and we can claim her as a Parkite. living here in Park City. Thanks so much for coming on the show again. Nice to have
you. Thank you. Thank you both
Thanks
so much.
Thanks for joining us.
And we'll be back after these words to talk about earthquakes.
Hey, this is Nick Spitzer. Join me here on KPCW for American Roots, our weekly two-hour music program from New Orleans. We bring you a wide range of American music, Sunday mornings at 11 a.m., supported by Donna Van Buren and Greater Park City Properties. American Roots, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Catch the high-flying action every Saturday and Sunday at 1 p.m. beginning June 25th and running through September 3rd with the Flying Ace All-Stars Freestyle Show. See Olympians and national team skiers and snowboarders soar up to 60 feet in the air before landing in the park's Spence Eccles Olympic Freestyle Pool. A great show for the whole family, this half-hour choreographed production will leave you breathless.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. On the heels of Hurricane Harvey, well, we almost hate to launch into another tale of natural disaster, but it's a fascinating story that most of us know nothing of. In the face of seismicity or seismic activity, it's just drastically changing in the United States, and unless you live in Florida, you're probably at risk for a significant seismic event. Yes, earthquakes. We're going to be speaking with Catherine Miles, who has written Quakeland, and she will tell us how Salt Lake City and 75% of Utah's population is on the Wasatch Fault Zone. There would be an estimated $33 billion lost in the economy if the fault were to rupture significantly. A report she discusses in the book says that Utah is not prepared for a major earthquake. Welcome to Cool Science Radio, Catherine.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, Lynn and I were both remarking on the book. It was really an eye-opener for us. And let's first talk about Salt Lake City.
Yeah, you know, and like a lot of your listeners, I really thought that earthquakes were a largely West Coast problem, and they're not. And places like Salt Lake City are at risk for a fairly significant quake, as you mentioned. And the damage, really, I think, is going to be worse than any of us can really imagine.
Yeah. And I went online last night, and I was looking at the specific fault lines in the Salt Lake area and looking at other ones in the country. And they seemed, and these fault lines seemed to, in many cases, look like a trapezoidal figure. It sort of like came in on itself. It wasn't like a straight line, and you would figure that that's where the continent would split. It actually, the fault lines were like one contiguous line that fed into itself. Did I describe that correctly?
Yeah, you know, I like to think of it almost like as a braid, you know, so lots of strands of hair. You know, we talk about faults, and we think it's a line or it's a single thing, but most often what we're really talking about is a fault zone, where there can be multiple faults happening in there, crisscrossing each other, lining up against one another, and that makes it even more difficult to understand, because within that fault zone, we don't know which part of the fault or which fault might be the one that's going to rupture, and that makes it really hard to plan for.
When was the last seismic event here along the Wasatch Fault?
So the last major seismic event, major earthquake, was about 1,300 years ago, which is obviously a really long time, but not in terms of geologic history and not in terms of geologic time. The fact that it's 1,300 years ago definitely shouldn't give us any comfort. We think that they occur about every 1,300 years, so that makes us really ready for another one.
So, you know, we've always heard about the San Andreas Fault that runs along California. And after that, is the Wasatch Fault the biggest in the West? Or where would we find the next biggest fault?
It's definitely one of the biggest. We're still really learning a lot about faults and where they are. We're discovering new faults all of the time. But the Wasatch is one of our major faults in the country. Another surprise one is the New Madrid Fault Zone, also a very large fault zone that is kind of runs under the Mississippi River around Memphis and St. Louis.
Okay.
Somebody showed me a map a couple of years ago of the Dallas-Fort Worth area going out about 30 miles in each direction. And there were two maps. The first map was seismic activity up until 20 years ago, which was, I mean, there just wasn't very much. And then in the last 20 years, it's taken off exponentially. And they believe that it had something to do with all the fracking that has been done in the area. Can you talk about man's involvement in forming earthquakes?
Sure. And for me, this was the big surprise and the most chilling surprise in my research for the book is, you know, I was aware, as I think most of your listeners were, of the sort of increase in earthquakes in places like Oklahoma and the idea that fracking and wastewater injection was responsible for them. We're seeing that in places like Dallas. There are fault lines that run directly under, for instance, both Love Field and the Dallas International Airport. That presents a major problem for them. But we're also seeing other kinds of induced earthquakes happening around the world in ways that would really surprise most people. So, for instance, when Hoover Dam was built and Lake Mead, the reservoir was filled, that area saw something like 10,000 earthquakes. When we have construction for things like giant tunnels, that can set off an earthquake. The largest high-rise apartment building in Taipei set off earthquake clusters. Mining, quarry activity, all of these things can significantly enhance the seismic risk in an area.
And you point out in the book in a number of places where this is a new science that relatively, I mean, there's not a lot of information on this science. And the reason is there's really nothing to study. It's not like a hurricane where you can send a bunch of planes or have satellites interrogating it or doing, I mean, there's a satellite now that can do a CAT scan of a hurricane. But we don't have that type of technology in use for the seismic activity. Can you talk about about the science of all of this?
Sure, sure. And, you know, my previous book was looking at Superstorm Sandy, and I spent quite a lot of time with the meteorologists at the National Hurricane Center, and they kept saying, you know, we're still not very good at this. You know, we still really can't do accurate predicting, and I think we saw that with Houston. I don't think anyone expected that level of rain to fall there. Seismic study is much harder even than the hurricane study, which is already really hard. And part of that is because so much of what's happening is happening miles below ground. The analogy that I make in the book is it's kind of like looking at an X-ray of a human body and deciding that you know how it works. You don't. You can kind of see the outline, but there's so much nuance that gets lost. And because we don't have a way to predict earthquakes, the scientists don't even know where to go to study them. And so much of their work is kind of this post-mortem kind of forensic analysis of what has happened, and that makes it even harder to understand what will happen.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Catherine Miles. She's written a new book called Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. So let's delve into that a little more, Catherine, about the predictability of seismic activity. Are there indicators, for example, a seismologist is monitoring seismic activity on a daily, hourly basis, and if you see some significant seismic activity that maybe we can't feel as we're walking about and conducting our daily lives, is that an indicator? Or, I mean, what is an indicator?
It can be. And there's some emerging science right now that's looking into this, what they call precursory activity, these foreshocks, these little quakes that can start rumbling. This is what happened in the last major earthquake in Chile, was we started to see these little quakes happening. And for some seismologists, that seemed like pretty good evidence that a big one was on the way. The problem is, not every little earthquake causes a big one. In fact, most little earthquakes don't cause a big one. So what we don't yet know how to do is to distinguish those little earthquakes that are just their own thing from those little earthquakes that are kind of the harbinger of that big one.
Right. We have spoken with a seismologist from the University of Utah before on this program, specifically about the seismic activity related to, well, and he watches that supervolcano in Yellowstone. and has done various reports on that. And he has said before, you know, that given that there wasn't a huge earthquake here, you know, for the last 1,400 years, like you say, it's still, to me, that presents a higher statistic that one would occur because we haven't had one in so long.
It's certainly possible. I mean, what we know is that as naturally occurring movement happens on these faults, pressure builds. And basically what happens is it builds and builds and builds until it can't build anymore, and it kind of explodes, for lack of a better term. And the analogy that I like to give, it's a sloppy one, but I think it works, is, you know, say you're filling up a water balloon, you know, and eventually, if you don't turn off that hose, the water balloon is gonna burst, right? So yes, pressure has been building on the Wasatch Fault for over 1,000 years. Eventually, that pressure is going to be more than it can take, and we're going to see this sort of, you know, tremendous violent release of that pressure, and it's going to manifest as an earthquake. When? We don't know. But you know, the fact remains that it could be tomorrow, and I think because that remains a fact, you know, that it's really up to us to start taking real action to minimize the devastation.
Yeah, and it's not the sky is falling. I mean, no one's saying that that this is right around the corner. It's going to happen, but I will say in reading your book, it was the Federal Emergency Management Agency that commissioned the Earthquake Engineering Research Institute, international consortium of geophysicists, engineers, architects, public planners, all of that. And they looked at Salt Lake and said, if a 7.0 or higher were to hit Salt Lake, a number of things would happen. And it's, you know, could be a lot of casualties, could be a lot of debris, could be a lot of people taken out of their homes. But one of the things it said in the report was that it appears that a 7.0 quake happens every 1,300 to 1,500 years. As you said, the last one was about 1,300 years ago. So it's kind of like Russian roulette. You really don't know, but it could happen.
It could, and that could should be enough. And like you said, you know, this is not the sky is falling, and we shouldn't all just, you know, be so terrified that we crawl under our beds and don't come out again. But recognizing that the threat is real, you know, I think we have a real responsibility to take action. And recognizing that the earthquake is going to manifest in ways that we don't expect. One of the biggest effects of an earthquake when it comes to damage is fire. And that's something that people don't necessarily expect. And so are we ready to deal with that? Do we have, for instance, enough burn unit space available for people? It's probably going to knock out cell phone towers. So how are we going to get in touch with our loved ones? If we need help, are we going to be able to ask for that help? These are the sorts of questions that, you know, if we start unpacking them right now as communities, as households, while things are calm and we have time to solve them, it can be the difference between, say, 7,000 people losing their lives and maybe no one losing their lives.
Right. And if there was a 7.0 quake and there were a lot of people that needed attention and a lot of things that the government would have to respond to, they probably wouldn't be bringing bottled water into the area for at least 2 or 3 days. So one of the first things you mentioned, and it's very easy to do, is just to stockpile some water, maybe have an emergency bag that might be able to have certain things in it that would help you. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Yeah, and every American should have one of these bags. It's what is sort of in the field they call a go bag, you know, because the threat of natural disaster is real for all of us. You know, it may not be the same disaster, but there is a threat. And so having a bag that contains ideally a week's worth of food, water, clothing for different temperatures, medicine, because what's going to happen in the event of this natural disaster, and we're seeing this in Houston right now, is those egresses, you know, streets, roads, the ability for a plane to land evaporates very quickly. And so while we have incredibly talented first responders in our communities, while we have, you know, robust National Guard units that are able to do incredible things, they may not be able to get to us. And so with that in mind, we're going to need to be able to shelter in place and take care of each other until real help can arrive.
Catherine, I wanted to ask you a little more about the human-induced earthquakes. And you take us in your book to 2007 to Crandall Canyon Mine here in Utah. and the catastrophic collapse that happened there. And talk about the relationship of coal mines and mines, any mine, to seismic activity.
Sure. And so going back to this water balloon analogy, this idea of pressure eventually bursting, whenever we do anything to the ground, we're changing pressure, whether we're pumping water into it like we see with the wastewater injection from fracking, or whether we're extracting things out of the earth, we're shifting pressure around. And as that pressure shifts, it can build in places that didn't have it before. And if it is building in a place of real vulnerability, then we see this sort of catastrophic break. Miners have known for as long as they've been mining, so well over 100 years, miners have been well familiar with a concept called rock bursts, where basically what they're doing is by mining, they're creating these tiny little earthquakes. Tiny in the sense that a seismometer might barely register them, but big in the sense that they can pose incredible threats to the lives of miners and, frankly, the people above ground. As we get more sophisticated with our ability to mine, as we're mining deeper, as we're able to take more out, these rock bursts are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so what we're starting to see is that the very act of mining is capable of causing earthquakes that can do real harm to people above ground.
Yeah, you say over a five-month period, they recorded in one Utah coal mine, not Crandall Canyon mine, but 13,000 seismic events, including a 4.2 quake on the Richter scale. That's incredible.
Yeah, and once you're up in those fours, you're starting to see damage that's occurring. Yeah. The other thing that's really sort of chilling is what we now know is that these little earthquakes can create a ripple effect that ultimately causes bigger earthquakes. And as they sort of ripple through the earth, they can set off these larger faults. That's a real concern in places like Oklahoma and places like Utah, where we know we have these loaded faults. And so what we don't know is just how many of those little mine earthquakes we need to set off a Wasatch Fault earthquake, but we do know that that's within the realm of possibility.
And in talking about Yellowstone, I had no idea the frequency was as high as 3,000 quakes per month at Yellowstone. Is that because the cauldron is so close to the surface, or is that because of the pressures?
It's a variety of factors. Certainly, that's part of it. There are these sort of magma plumes that occur, you know, deep within the earth, and ultimately sort of burn through, almost like a blowtorch, burn through the earth. It's how we ended up with the Hawaiian Islands. And Yellowstone is sitting on a sort of particularly thorny one of these, which is a fascinating study, you know, for all of us in terms of how the earth works. You know, if you really want to see how the earth works, and that's why I start the book at Yellowstone, you can't do better than there because, you know, we see this geyser activity. We see these sinkholes. We see this constantly changing landscape. And it's sort of in miniature what's happening across this planet.
Well, let's take a minute and talk about the 1959 Yellowstone earthquake, about what actually happened, the damage that occurred, and what we learned from all of this.
So this is a really interesting moment in U.S. history that does not get talked about nearly enough. The Hebgen Lake earthquake, it was centered just west of Yellowstone. Not all that large of an earthquake by national standards, and yet one that did amazing damage. And I think that it's a really great and important case study of what the future may hold for us. And in the book, I tell the story of one particular family who was out on the all-American vacation. They had loaded up their camper and their dog and their fishing rods, and they had gone to Yellowstone and then were camping alongside this river in a valley when the earthquake occurred in the middle of the night. The earthquake created one of the largest, if not the largest, landslides in U.S. history, which did an amazing amount of damage. And the aftermath and the degree to which we were able to respond to it, I think, really showed kind of a litmus test about what needs to happen in terms of our ability to help one another.
Wow. You know, just wanted to go through some of the interviews. Your book is, and I always love when a journalist takes a particular topic and does so much research into it, but tells a story at the same time. And you do this with these interviews among some really interesting people. One of those, if you could talk about, I think it's Charles Mergurian, who spends his days in the sewers and tunnels under New York City tracking some of these faults. You interview him in the book.
Sure. And this is my favorite part of my job, is that I get to kind of play, if you're familiar with James Thurber's story, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, I get to play Miner, and I get to play forensic detective and everything else for the day. And one of the surprises for me when I was writing the book was just how much seismic potential there is in places like Washington, D.C., Boston, and New York. And as it turns out, as he is discovering, New York City is absolutely riddled with faults. And so this is a guy who likes to put on work clothes and some really mucky boots and goes down into the sort of dankest and darkest of the subway tunnels and is mapping all of these faults in in New York City, in the subway system, and is really sort of changing what we know about seismic risk in New York.
Oh, interesting. And so for those people in the know, I mean, what are they thinking? What are these emergency managers urging their municipalities to do? Is it at that point where it's, you know, like, hey, this is a wake-up call?
It really is. And, you know, it's so variable. You know, an earthquake in the Northwest is going to cause very different problems than an earthquake in, say, Utah. You know, I mean, if you're living in Oregon and Washington or Northern California, the threat of tsunami is real, and a major tsunami event. So that requires a different kind of attention than, say, an earthquake happening in Utah, where we could be looking at massive landslides, we could be looking at massive avalanches that are happening. So while the devastation may be kind of similar, the causes of the devastation is very different. And I think that that's important.
Right.
And recognizing, again, those sort of ripple effects, the fact that fire is going to be a problem, the fact that communication is going to be a problem, that, you know, we could see outbreaks of things like typhus and cholera because we no longer have the ability to manage our sewage. Those are the sort of surprise problems that we tend not to think about.
And of course, Catherine, you talk about Salt Lake City's International Airport, which is built on unstable water-saturated soil that could liquefy if an earthquake were to hit it. Apparently, all of this is serious enough that the monies that have been budgeted and the construction that is going on for the new airport or this big remodel is not just to make it a fancy new millennium airport, but it's also to earthquake-proof the airport because it wasn't before. And if there was a disaster, I mean, you've got to be able to get planes in and out of the city.
And some really great innovative structural work is happening. I think that the rest of the country is really going to look at some of those renovations and additions as sort of a gold standard in terms of what's happening to create a building that won't just withstand an earthquake, but also can be a place of refuge. You know, when we talk about building codes and buildings being built to seismic code, all that means is that the building is going to be standing at the end of the quake. It does not mean that the building will be functional. It doesn't mean that the building will be safe. It doesn't mean that it'll ever be occupied again. And I think a lot of people don't know that. What's happening at the Salt Lake Airport is a new level of sort of seismic consideration, which is really great. And Salt Lake City is full of these examples. You know, there's been really interesting renovations and retrofitting that's happened, for instance, with the Mormon Tabernacle, things that are being done to preserve these historic, beautiful structures, as well as to create these new safe ones.
Yeah, I think you point out in the book that the Oregon has been completely earthquake-proofed so that nothing will happen to that. But I think more importantly than the Oregon would be, there are a number of Mormon-owned buildings in Salt Lake that are really up to code, aren't they?
They are, and using really interesting, innovative designs, things like rollers and pads that allow the building to sort of sway in concert with an earthquake. The Church of Latter-day Saints has a robust team of engineers and people with seismic expertise who are regularly dispatched whenever an earthquake happens. That was a fact I didn't know researching the book, and they've been really sort of instrumental in helping places like Haiti in the after effect of an earthquake as well, too. So it's really one of those it takes a village kind of situations.
It's funny. I've been to the Salt Lake City Airport a handful of times this summer, and every time I go down there, I look at the renovation and I say, I swear I heard this was somewhere in the neighborhood of a $3 billion reconstruction. How can that possibly be? I must have heard it incorrectly. But in fact, as you state in your book, $2.9 billion construction process, and that is why. Now we know it's about seismic upgrades.
Yeah, and important ones. And, you know, you all living in the realm of the Great Salt Lake, you know, there's a whole nother level of threat that lake could possibly pose with an earthquake as well, too. And so when it comes to the siting of things like airports, prisons, things like that, you could very well be dealing with flooding. And some experts think that you could even have some tsunami activity as a result of that.
Wow.
I hadn't thought about that. And as you mentioned again in the book, that it's water-saturated soil that the airport is built on and the threat of liquefaction. I would not know what that is if I had not seen the footage, the videos of the San Francisco earthquake around the time of the World Series between Oakland and San Francisco. And what that liquefaction actually did, I mean, it actually turns the dirt into some sort of, I mean, it looks like liquid. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and it's a really hard concept to get your head around if you haven't seen it. But as you say, you know, the earth, you know, begins to act like a liquid, you know, and you start to see, you can see it, for instance, in sort of like a landslide type activity where it's almost like it's kind of pouring in a wave. This can happen for a variety of different reasons because of the soils. When the soils are water saturated, as they are in a lot of the sort of Salt Lake area, then you have literal liquid that you're dealing with in addition to soil that's acting like a liquid. And it becomes incredibly unstable. There's a lot of movement. And buildings tend not to respond favorably to that type of movement. So again, a very different type of earthquake activity than we would see, for instance, were it to occur out east, where we have a lot of sort of bedrock and granite. The shaking feels different in that
yes.
case. And that can make it really hard to create buildings that are responsive because the shaking is so different.
Okay. Catherine Miles has written Quakeland, On the Road to America's Next Devastating Earthquake. Catherine, thanks so much for being with us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Well, we shall return right after these messages. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
This is Nanette Bush with Fairway Independent Mortgage, supporter and longtime listener of KPCW. Fairway Independent Mortgage offers personal home, vacation home, and investment property lending. Our mortgage team partners with local realtors to provide our clients with resources to understand the home finance process. Located at 1700 Park Avenue or at nanettebush.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. We want to thank our underwriters, the Natural History Museum of Utah, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, and San Francisco Design. Want to also thank our guest today, Dr. Barbara Worosko, as well as Catherine Miles and her book, Quakeland.